Special request to have some teaching this afternoon on the Sutta Nipata. And who wants to tell us about the Sutta Nipata? This is the Rhinoceros Sutra, not the Sutta Nipata? What does this tell us about Chinese education? Okay.
Failed the flood.
This is not correct.
What's that?
The Nipata is also a very early Buddhist.
Is it? That's what I'm asking you.
That's what I was told.
That's what I just said. You were reading something off the board.
Any other suggestions, opinions, thoughts, analysis?
I think it's widely regarded as being one of the earliest Buddhist texts, but in one of the books by Sujato, it says that actually not all of it is the practice.
Thanks, Jackie. How to get good marks in the class, yeah. Parayanavaga?
Are referred to as complete collections in other sutras, so they are most likely collections.
Yep. So, is it 15 books? Kudakanikaya, that's right, 15 books. Depending on which version, Burmese have more. Yeah. Okay, so. That's pretty good. So Sutta Nipata is a collection of verses. Sutta Nipata literally just means a collection of suttas. And it's a collection of verses arranged in five chapters, unlike the verses of the Dhammapada, where the verses tend to be just individual verses which are arranged in chapters by themes. Sutta Nipata, the verses tend to be more coherent, so it's like they're actual poems. A typical Sutta Nipata sutta might have, say, 20 verses or something like that in it. A few of them have some prose introduction or conclusion, some prose sections, but the majority of them are just straight verses. The verses are not typically not explicitly attributed to the Buddha in the text itself. It just gives the verses and doesn't say that the Buddha spoke them. But it's usually assumed that most of them were spoken by the Buddha. And as a collection, the Sutta Nipata is unique to the Pali tradition. Okay, so there's, as far as I know, no correlation to the Sutta Nipata as such. But sections of the Sutta Nipata have correlates in other Buddhist traditions. And the main or the most important sections here are the ones which are already mentioned, the Attakavagga and the Parayanavagga, as well as the what's known as the Rhinoceros Horn Sutta, which is probably the most famous of all the poems in here. So this is the I'll be reading today or using the translation by K.R. Norman. It's a paperback translation actually titled The Rhinoceros Horn. Norman's one of the problems with the Sutta Nipata in English is that we haven't really got a really good translation in the same way that we have for a lot of the prose texts now. Actually, the two main ones which are used are the ones I have here by Sadatissa and K.R. Norman, which are tend to be a bit kind of two opposite poles. K.R. Norman's is almost completely non-poetic and algebraic. He himself describes his poetic style as algebraic. Whereas Sadatissa's tends to be quite loose and capturing the spirit of it rather than trying to be a literal translation. So if you just wanted to read it to have a nice read, then Sadatissa's version is very good. If you want to actually study it in any depth and figure out precisely what they're saying, then K.R. Norman's is good. I think then Orta Nisro also has a translation. There's been several translations done. It was one of the earliest texts actually translated into Western languages, and has been subject to a lot of study since the 19th century in the West. There are versions of it and corresponding versions found in other collections. There's a Atthakavagga and so on has here various parts of it found in Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit and Gandharan, as well as various things in the Tibetan and Chinese traditions. Okay, so it's quite widely well known. These early texts are quite widely found and well known. Just to come back to this claim it has here, this is just a Wikipedia article, and it just says, it has this controversy very briefly here. Some scholars consider this the oldest of all Buddhist scriptures. Others agree that it contains much very early material. So no one disputes the fact that it contains early material, but whether it's the oldest of all Buddhist scriptures is just another. That's a bit how Tony Abbott would describe climate change. In fact, there are some suttas in here which are quite obviously fairly late. And one of the most obvious ones is the Nalaka Sutta. Yeah. It has the one of the early versions of the story of Asita, the sage who saw when the Bodhisattva was to be born, or when he was born, and came and predicted that he would be become a Buddha. It starts out, the seer Asita saw in their daytime resting place the joyful group of the 30 gods who were glad having honoured Indra, and he saw the devas in their clean clothes holding up their garments, praising exceedingly. Then he goes on and talks to the devas about why they're so happy. And here, K.R. Norman's translation says, why is the group of devas exceedingly happy? I remember Nyanamoli's translation of the same phrase, he says, why are the gods extravagantly gay? not a translation that you'd want to use these days. And so then it goes. So this, in terms of and then it talks about how he sees the Buddha who is glowing like the burning gold burnished in the very mouth of the furnace, resplendent with glory, with perfect colour, the young prince blazing with fire, purified like the Lord of Stars going in the sky, like the gleaming sun released from clouds in autumn, and so on and so forth. While a god held in the sky an umbrella with many ribs and 1,000 circles, yak-tail fans with golden handles fluttered up and down, and the holders of the umbrella and the fans were invisible. And so on and so forth. So it goes on this to things which obviously we are a style of literature that much more associated with the later, quite extravagant hagiographies of the Buddha than the early texts. And not only that, but the metrical style and the poetic style are unambiguously late of that particular sutta. So I'm just reading this out to start with, just to show that this, the idea that Suttanipata as a collection as a whole obviously can't be earlier than the latest of its elements. Right? So obviously if some of the suttas are late, then the collection as a whole must be quite late. Nevertheless, it does contain some early material. And personally, I think even the earliness of the early material is overstated, and is much more to do with Western scholarly fads than with any kind of particular empirical evidence. But nevertheless, there are some early material which is of interest. I mean, the late material also is of interest, but just for different reasons, that's all. Okay, so let's have a look at some of the important suttas here, and we'll start with the Rhinoceros Horn Sutta. Right.
Is there any particular reason why the compilers decided to put the content of the Suttanipata into the Suttanipata?
Yeah, I'm not sure that's been studied in detail. Yeah, why this particular way? Because it's probably a decision made in Sri Lanka, and you know, it's part of the process of redacting the Khuddaka Nikaya, which always remained somewhat more flexible than others. Why this particular arrangement was made, I'm not really sure. Yeah, I haven't read anything about that. I should just mention that Suttanipata does contain some of the best known and best loved of the Buddhist scriptures, in particular the Metta Sutta, Ratna Sutta, and Mangala Suttas are all found here. So let's just go to the Kagavisana Sutta. Okay. Laying aside violence in respect of all beings, violence here being the danda, the stick, not harming a single one of them. One should not wish for a son, let alone a companion. One should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Affection comes into being for one who has associations. Following on affection, this misery arises. This dukkha arises. Seeing the peril that is born from affection, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. So the word for affection here is sneha. So sneha is different from metta or something like that, but it means specifically, usually means like familial attachment, and is etymologically related to the English words snow and snot. Yes, I'm being serious. Right. Snot is a very ancient word. Literally means like moisture. So moisture binds things together and sticks them together, yeah? So you have, in English you have the idiom, the water of love. So sneha is kind of like that.
Yeah. So snot's the water of love?
No. Sangsaga jatasa. And sangsaga, the word he uses for association here, has it's not quite the same word as the word for like a friend or something like that, but it's usually mean in the sense of basically always being busy with people, always hanging around with people. Mitte suhajje anukampamano, sympathizing with friends and companions, one misses one's goal, being shackled in mind. Aperti. So one's goal is destroyed. One's mind is Pakibadha, bound up. Seeing the danger in acquaintance, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. They just get lost, a lot of you. I don't want to see you. If I have any compassion for you, then my holy life is going to be destroyed. That's what this verse is saying. So I don't want to see you again.
Is this a terrible rules?
Is that what it's saying?
No.
Isn't it? You don't think so? So then
only
you
when, only when the people around you are not cultivating, then you have to become like a hearing or a master. Uh-huh. When you have Kalyana Mitra, I'm sure you can be together.
Yeah?
Also, I'm not going to say the psychological reading for the everyday reading.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
True that most rhinoceroses have two horns, don't they? Is that quite true?
This is a controversial thing.
Sorry,
yeah, Indian rhinoceroses have one horn.
Africans have two.
Yeah, but the Indian rhinoceroses also love to hang around in herds as well. Problem. And
I don't know which
chapter
it is, but
we
have a unicorn horn.
Yeah, that's right. Sadatisi uses that. Yeah. The translation of Kagavisana is actually notoriously problematic. It says here there is an ongoing dispute about whether the title Sword Horn Sutra is to be taken as a Tatpurisa compound, a sword which is a horn, or as a Bahubrihi compound, one who has a sword as a horn. In the former case, the title should be rendered the Rhinoceros Horn Sutra. In the latter case, it should be rendered the Rhinoceros Sutra. There is textual evidence to support either interpretation. So people have written whole articles and stuff. So obviously what we're getting here is a particular take on the holy life, which has been, is one of the reasons why it's regarded as one of the early texts, is because it's felt that this emphasis on the solitary life is quite different from the emphasis on sangha life and community life, which is often found within many of the prose suttas. So this is one of the sources for this feeling. It's traditionally said that at least some of these... We'll just read a few more verses and then we'll... The consideration that is which exists for sons and wives is like a very wide-spreading bamboo tree entangled with others. Like a young bamboo shoot not caught up with others, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. So this is the wangsa. So the idea, there's also a pun here in the Pali which doesn't come across, because wangsa is a word for bamboo. It's also a word for lineage. So if you're getting up, caught up in your family lineage, then this also is a problem.
What about monastic lineage?
Well, that's different, obviously.
Is it?
Migo aramyam hi yata abadho yeni chakang gacchati gocharaya vinyunaro seritam pekhamano ekocharay khagavishana kapo. So as a deer which is not tied up goes wherever it wishes in the forest for pasture, an understanding man having regard for his independence should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. So here this kind of imagery is found quite a lot in the suttas, and I really like this particular verse. And just notice the use of the word seri here, as in sister seri. This is the seri, the independence, so the freedom. In the midst of companions, whether one is resting, standing, going, or wandering, there are requests from others. Having regard for the independence, which is not coveted by others, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn.
Okay, so look at that ownership there. The independence not coveted by others.
Well, it could be interpreted on a number of levels, yeah. I mean, on a basic level, it just, I think, refers to the fact that if you're staying among people, then people are kind of asking you for things, or, you know, jealousies and covetousness and so on tend to arise. So.
It's like usually most people are interested in
Yeah. Not always true, though. Kidda. In the midst of companions is kidda, which means kidding around. Rati hoti sahaya majhe. In the midst of companions there are sport, enjoyment, and great love for sons. The word they use for sons, it's a bit ambiguous, but it's a bit like the way that we use kind of man or something like that in English, where you just, the default gender becomes the used, but it also did mean that they actually cared a lot more about having sons than daughters. Although loathing separation from what is dear, one should wander alone like a rhinoceros horn. One is a man of the four quarters and not hostile, being pleased with whatever comes one's way. A fearless bearer of dangers, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. So this translation not entirely clear, but chaturdiso apati gaho chahoti, chaturdiso. These words, chaturdiso means being one of the four quarters, and apatigo means not resisting. So basically it means that you're just living in a life of openness where you're not resisting or favouring anything from any direction. One's iti rita rena, this is a word that's used, iti rita ra is a word that's used for the one's robes and other requisites. So one's just content with any old kind of robe. Even some wanderers are not kindly disposed, and also some householders dwelling in a house, having little concern for the children of others, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Having removed the marks of a householder, like a kowilara tree whose leaves have fallen, a hero having cut the householder's bonds, wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. So the word for hero here is vira, still commonly found as a proper name, both as a Dhamma name, also just as an ordinary name in Thai, and certainly in Thailand, but obviously related to the English vira.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
Can you explain what you
mean by
family?
Aren't you
still forming some kind of attachments and being together as well?
No, we all hate each other.
You still form attachments wherever you are, isn't it?
Is that right?
Are you saying, is it right or is it true? Is that the fact happening, or is that the purpose? Which one?
Like,
I made
arrangements to leave.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to go now.
You don't want to go? Just asking. It seems to say when I left my family, I didn't want to leave. Uh-huh. But I come here and feel the same way.
Isn't this
advocating
the life of
wandering?
Aspect?
Mm-hmm.
Communal.
Mm. It's seems to me, yeah.
I think the Master will be the right place for a priest or someone to stay at the community. This is where I'm waiting for a normal for somebody like that.
Yeah. But I mean, obviously there is a sense in which we do, you know, we displace those kind of attitudes and so on that we have for our family, and then we come into the monastery and so on, we tend to have the same attitudes towards people in the monastery. So that obviously happens. So another question is whether it should happen. I mean, in a sense, it's just a human thing, you know. It's not something you necessarily have a lot of control about, you know. And one of the things that is a bit different in a monastery is that, firstly, you're more conscious of it, and secondly, I think that monasteries tend to change more, in my experience. And if you get completely, you know, I mean, if I was as traumatized by every person who left the monastery as I would be with every person who you know, leaving your mum or something like that, then yeah, you're going to be spending quite a bit of time being traumatized. So you know, you have more of a kind of an extended family that is not so tightly bound up with one or two people. So I think that's part of the in a practical sense, part of the job is to learn to kind of extend that kind of emotional love and acceptance and trust to people who are not someone who you necessarily grew up with. They're not maybe someone you even share a lot in common with, but somebody who you know you can come together with and feel that affinity for. But then you have to also test that. So I think that's a very important thing to do, you know, at least at some time in your practice, is to actually do that. You know, to really just spend you know, a year or something like that, just living completely by yourself and not having that contact with anyone.
Okay, do that when
you're children. Probably problem solved. I mean, you do. It's not easy to do, but you can certainly, you know, you can at least try, you know.
How do you mean try? Just go to the forest and see how long you can do that.
Well, that would be one way of trying, yeah. Yeah, that's one way. Yeah. Take some instant noodles with you. I mean, traditionally, monks would do what it talks about here, is they would do the tudong and they just wander around from village to village. In that case, you're kind of seeing people, but you're not making any attachments with people. You just go from one place to the other. These days, that's fairly hard to do. You can do it. You can still do it to some degree in some places. But, you know, you can certainly find places where you can live more or less alone for long periods of time. You still see a few people now and then, but you can keep that pretty minimal. I think that's a good thing to do it, you know, for a certain period of time. Some people respond to that in different ways.
Maybe also that you refer to letting go of all conventions and just risking to have your own experience instead of following all conventions and concepts.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. That's a very important thing. It's what you're doing here is you're leaving aside that constructed world, the world of culture, where there's the expectations to behave and to think and so on in certain ways. And then you're just really throwing yourself into the wild, where anything is possible. I mean, this is why, you know, the general advice in Buddhism and in the Vinaya and so on is to have a period of several years of training first, so that, you know, one only goes into the forest and so on when one's ready. Obviously, some people can do it straight away, but for most people, it's important to have those structures and so on to fall back on. You have them there, you know, you have some wisdom and so on to know how to do that. When you need to, you know, when the conventions are needed. Yeah.
So there is one contradiction in a way that, like, on one hand, the Buddha is always praising like solitude and stuff, and on the other hand, he always, you know, he set up a structure that actually the Sangha live together and have all this, you know, Sangha act together and live in community. So is it any kind of
Well, let's just have a look at the next few verses, because the next few verses actually directly address that very problem. Okay, so we'll just have a look at that and see if that gives us any advice on that. If one should obtain sachela beta nipakang sahayam, if one should gain a zealous companion, zealous meaning diligent or conscientious companion, an associate of good disposition, a sadhu vihari, someone who dwells together, an adhira, a wise person, who is resolute, overcoming all dangers, one should wander with him with elated mind and mindful. Then the next verse, if one cannot obtain a zealous companion, an associate of good disposition who is conscientious, then like a king quitting the kingdom which he has conquered, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. This gives a completely different last line here. In the Kagavisana. The K.R. Norman has the same last line. These verses are actually found elsewhere. I think they're found in the Dhammapada and other places. But these two verses were given, I think, in the Vinaya, following the dispute at Kosambi. And so where you had the Sangha who was all in disputing and so on and arguing with each other, and then the Buddha just said, okay, I'll leave that like a king abandoning his kingdom. He's just wanders into the forest, so the Buddha just left them and then went to stay by himself. And so this in a sense gives another piece of advice. It may be because this first verse here doesn't have the refrain, and the second one seems to have some ambiguity about whether it has the same refrain or a different one. It may be that these verses come from outside of the rhinoceros horn tradition as such. As a Wikipedia article notes, that the different versions of this, as one would expect, have slightly different verses. They have a very similar kind of tenor, but the verses will change and differ, and the sequence of them will change and so on and so forth. So it seems to me likely that these couple of verses are probably slightly outside the strict tradition of the Kagavisana Sutta, and they sort of seem to have a slightly different tenor. Perhaps even the tradition itself felt the need to sort of soften the very uncompromising message of the rhinoceros horn verses by putting these ones here. So the basic message of these ones is that, well, if you can have good companions who are actually going to be helpful in your spiritual practice, then you should live with them and support each other. But if you can't get any, then that's when you need to go off by yourself.
What does that mean, anger and you?
Oh, it's naga is a naga. Naga is probably an elephant here. Aranya is a forest. Matanga, I'm not quite sure what matanga is. Matanga, a young serpent, okay, an elephant. So this means basically the same as a naga. Like a naga or an elephant in the forest. And so one should one would then translate that as one should wander alone like a great bull elephant in the forest. Adha pasangsama sahaya sampadan. Surely let us praise the good fortune of having a companion. Friends who are better than oneself or equal to oneself are to be associated with. If one does not obtain these in enjoying only blameless things, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Seeing shiny bracelets of gold well made by a smith clashing together when two are on one arm, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. It's a classic Indian image here. And of course, you know, if you go to India today, you see all the women always wear all these bangles on their arms. They're all kind of jingling together. And that's even found in the Indus Valley. So we're talking 2000, 3000 BC. You see all of these images, and the women always have stacks of bangles up. That's a 5,000-year-old fashion, and it's still not going out of style. And the sound of the jingling of them, it must have been, completely like a whole idiom in the culture. that, you know, you can hear when the woman's approaching the room or something like that, because she's jingling away with all the bangles. And you find this image used in a similar way in some of the Jataka stories and other places as well. Okay, in the same way, then with a companion there would be objectionable talk or abuse with me. Seeing this danger for the future, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Kama hichitra madhura manorama virupa rupena matenti chittam. There's another verse that appears in different places. This is, says, for sensual pleasures are various, sweet and delightful. So you can just quote that first verse if you say, what did the Buddha think about sensuality? Just quote that. Virupa rupena matenti chittang, but with forms due to the deformation of form, they hassle the mind, something like that. They disturb the mind with their manifold form. It's a translation here, but it's virupa rupena. Rupa is a form, virupa is a deformation. With the deformation of form, they stress out the mind. Seeing this peril in these sensual pleasures, one should wander alone like a rhinoceros horn. Iti jagando. This is a calamity for me, a tumour and a misfortune, a disease, a barb and a danger. Seeing this danger in the strands of sensual pleasure, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. So the word iti we chant in the morning chanting, sabitiyo vivadantu. Okay, so may all calamities be averted. And just to note that this word, the guna, Kaya Norman here follows the Pali tradition in translating guna as a strand or a cord. That explanation is not found in the northern traditions at all. And that probably just means a quality or type of sensuality, different types of sensual pleasure. Cold and heat, hunger and thirst, wind and the heat of the sun, gadflies and snakes, having endured all these, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. This is a standard list of the different kinds of physical discomfort which you have to endure living in the forest. As an elephant with massive shoulders, spotted noble, may leave the herds and live as it pleases in the forest, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. It is an impossibility for one who delights in company to obtain even temporary release. Having heard the voice of the sun's kinsman, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Natana means it's not possible. For one who delights sanghamika rata, for someone who loves socializing, then it's impossible for such a one to even get the samayikang vimuting. So samayikang vimuting is basically a term for jhanas, or for samadhi, various kinds of samadhi attainment. And this is spoken by the Adichya Bandhu, the kinsman of the sun. This is a term used for the Buddha, and it relates ultimately to, obviously is a metaphor for the Buddha's wisdom, also relates to the fact that the Sakyan clan, like many of the royal families in India, traced its lineage back to what's called the solar lineage. And it's founded by King Okaka, ultimately. And I think we met King Okaka in the Jatakas somewhere, yeah? His name, Ikshvaku, is a sugar cane, and ultimately said to be descended from the sun. And there's a complementary lunar lineage of royal lineage descended from the moon. Having gone beyond the contortions of wrong view, arrived at the fixed course of salvation, and gained the way, thinking I have knowledge arisen in me, I'm not to be led by others, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. So this is the dipi visukani upati vato. So there's the contortions or the view, the twistings of views. One has gained to that niyama, right? One gained to the fixed destiny. One has attained patiladha, the path. One has gained the path, and then there is upanyanam. Knowledge has arisen, which cannot be led by another. Now, this is obviously referring to stream entry. Now, this kind of verse is one of the reasons why I dispute this idea that these kinds of verses in some way doctrinally distinct from and prior to the developed doctrines found in the prose section of the Tripitaka, because it seems to me that this kind of verse is only explicable in terms of understanding the ordinary doctrine of a stream enterer as presented many, many times in the prose suttas. If you didn't understand what a stream enterer was and so on, then a lot of these terms would be either meaningless or so vague as to be virtually meaningless. But if you understand the prose suttas, each one of these has a very specific meaning, which is entirely in accord with the meanings in the prose suttas. The dipti, the contortions of views, are of course the wrong views about a self, which are eradicated by a stream enterer. One has gained to the patta niyama. The niyama is the fact that a stream enterer is destined for enlightenment and is not can't be reborn more than seven times. Patiladhamagga refers to the fact that they have attained and possess the Noble Eightfold Path in all its respects. Upananyana means that they have the knowledge of the Four Noble Truths, specifically the Four Noble Truths, but also dependent origination and other forms of knowledge that are arisen in terms of direct perception to the stream enterer. And Ananyaneya means that because they have seen that truth for themselves, that they are no longer in need of a teacher to guide them or to teach anything else, because they've seen it for themselves. So each of these is a very straightforward reference to quite well understood and standard aspects of stream entry in the prose canon, and it seems to me that in terms of a poetic presentation of these things, this must be subsequent and depend on the prose presentation rather than the other way around. Okay, next one. Nilolupo nikuho nipipaso nimakho nidhantaka sav moho nirasayo sabaloke bhavitva eko tere khagavisana kapo. So here we have some more obviously poetic constructions, and all the kind of the use of the prefix and the rhythms and so on. Having become without covetousness, without deceit, without thirst, without hypocrisy, with delusion and faults blown away, without any inclination to evil in the whole world, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Papang sahayang parivajayeta anatadasing visamena vietang sayang naseve pasutang pamatang eko jare kagga visana kapo. One should avoid an evil companion, one who does not see the goal, who has entered upon bad conduct. One should not oneself associate with one who is intent upon wrong views and is negligent. One should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Bahusutang dhammadharang bhajeta mitang ularang patibhanavantang anyaya atani vinaya gankang eko jare kagavisana kapo. One should cultivate somebody who is of great learning, expert in the doctrine, a noble friend possessed of intelligence. Knowing one's goals, having dispelled doubt, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. And again, this being another one of these verses which seems to clearly depend on the existence of obviously somebody who is a Dhammadhara, someone who's memorized the Dhamma. So obviously referring presumably to the various prose suttas. Someone who's Bahusutang, who's very learned, and again, so seeming to presuppose the existence of a substantial canon of accepted scriptures. And one's friend, who is an excellent friend, and who is Patibhanavantang, and the word Patibhana most literally and straightforwardly refers to the ability to extemporize poetry. Right, so that's the kind of friend who you want, right? Somebody who's going to break into verse at a moment's notice. Yeah, it's a bit like a kind of you know, Bollywood musical or something like that. And they're just going to, you know, oh, it's coming without the. That. Yeah, primarily. Bahusutan, we find that constantly. Such as Bahusutan. Okay, and you know, very important this one, Anyayatani, one who knows the meaning of things and is able to dispel doubts. So this is of course one of the great benefits of learning and studying the Dhamma, that one's able to dispel various kinds of doubts on various issues that arise. So this is not something which is not a small thing, something that's very important. And now then, not finding satisfaction in sport. and enjoyment. Nor in the happiness that comes from sensual pleasures in the world, and paying no attention to them, abstaining from adornment. Oh, that's even worse now. We can't even wear makeup. Analankaritva. Anapekkhamanno, not having regard for it. Speaking the truth, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Kutancha dharang pitarancha matarang dhanani dhanyani jabandhavani hitwana kamani yatodikani eko tarek haggavisana kapo. Leaving behind son and wife, mother and father, wealth and grain, relatives and sensual pleasures to the full extent, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Sango eso paritameta sokyang apasado dukameta bhiyo galo eso itinyatma matima eko chare kagavisana kapo. This is an attachment, a sangha, not the word sangha with an H in there, meaning sangha. This is sangha, meaning attachment. There is very little happiness and little satisfaction. There is very much misery. This is a hook. Knowing this, a thoughtful man would wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Sandalayitwa sangyojanani jalangva behetwa salilambuchari agiva dadhang anivattamano eko tere kagavisana kapo. Having torn one's fetters asunder like a fish breaking a net in the water, not returning like a fire which does not return to what is already burnt, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. So some great images in that one. Okita chakhu natapada lolo gutindriyo rakita manasano anavasuto paridaihamano eko chare khagavisana kapo. With eyes cast downwards, being one of the Sekhiya rules, one's eyes should be cast down. Natapada lolo, not footloose. They translate, and this is a great idiom, literally is pada, is a foot. Lola is literally like loose or wanton. With sense faculties guarded, gutindriyo, and with mind protected, rakita manasano. Not overflowing with defilements, not burning, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Harangitwa gihi bhyanjanani sanchanna patto yatha parijatto kasaya vatto abhinikkhamitwa ego jare khagavisana kapo. Having discarded the marks of a householder like a coral tree whose leaves have fallen, and gone out from the house wearing the saffron robe, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. So the kasaya, often said to be the yellow robe or the saffron robe, kasaya literally meaning, literally doesn't refer to a colour so much as to something which is discoloured. So these days I translate it as the ochre robe, mainly because it gives a nice Aussie kind of feeling to it. Rase sugedhan akarang alolo ananyaposi sapadana chari kule kule apatibadha jitto eko chare khagavisana kapo. Showing no greed for flavours, not wanton, not supporting others, going on an uninterrupted begging round. So this word sapadanachari refers to a pindabat practice where you don't have like a sort of recognized houses or places that you go for alms round, but you would just go and wait for a set amount of time at each house, or just wander evenly through the village from house to house without giving preference, for example, to places that you know are going to give you some alms. Not shackled in mind to this family or that, one should wander alone like rhinoceros horn. Kule kule apatibadha chitto, not being attached among various families. Bahaya pancha varanani chetaso upakilese byapanujja sabbe anisuto chetva sineha dosang eko charek hagavisana kapo. Having left behind the five hindrances of the mind, having thrust away all defilements, not dependent, having cut off affection and hate, one should wander alone as a rhinoceros horn. And this being another sutta, which obviously refers to the standard doctrinal category of the five hindrances, and whereas normally have the pancha nivarana, here we have the panchavarana, which is required for the metta, but the either nivarana or avarana are used as synonyms in the prose suttas. So here, just again being another case where obviously you wouldn't know what that verse meant unless you already knew what the five hindrances were. Okay, so it's referring to an already accepted doctrinal category. And word, it says, translated as defilements here, is upakilesa, and upakilesa is not quite as strong as defilement, really, but upakilesa is very similar to the nivarana, and refers mainly to the more kind of subtle obstacles to development of samadhi, rather than to the underlying root defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion, for example. So that's just a distinction to notice when you're reading the suttas. Actually, the word usually in modern Buddhism, the most common word for defilement is kilesa, but the word kilesa is not actually found all that commonly in the suttas. You find a lot of other words for defilements used much more standardly. So just to remember that what's meant by upakilesa here is more just the feeling of restlessness in meditation or something like that, rather than the root level underlying defilements as such. Okay. Okay, vipitti katvana sukhang dukancha pubeva chasomanasa domanasang laddha nubekhang samathang visudhang eko jare khagga visanaka. Okay, having put happiness and misery behind oneself and joy and dejection already, having gained equanimity, which is purified calmness, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. So, this being obviously again a description of the fourth jhana, and using this similar technical terminology that we find in the fourth jhana formula itself. Interesting, but varied around to fit into the meter a little bit, but this first phrase is actually quite interesting. The translation is, having put happiness and misery behind oneself, and it actually being more literal meaning, literal translation than it would appear. The word piti is the word for one's back. Okay, so wi piti katwa literally means putting it behind your back. Okay, that's what means the sukha and dukkha has been put behind your back. And notice how in sukha, normally sukha has one k. Okay, dukkha normally has two k's, and here to fit into the meter, one of the k's is dropped, so it's sukhang dukhancha rather than sukhang dukhancha. Pubeva cha somanasa domanasang is almost a direct quote from the formula for the fourth jhana. So of course it's referring to the letting go of all the feelings of the blissful feelings of the first three jhanas, both. And they're kind of re-emphasizing this. One has gained equanimity, which is the samathang visuddhang. So interesting that in the corresponding phrase in the fourth jhana formula is upekha satipabhi suddhing, so which is upekha and mindfulness, and parisuddhi, which is a synonym for visuddhi, but here mindfulness is replaced by samatha. So whereas samatha and mindfulness are sometimes said to be opposing forms of meditation, here the word samatha appears exactly the same place that the word mindfulness normally appears. So again, the samatha here being... It's actually somewhat unusual. Normally samatha is used in a much more general sense to talk about the development of tranquility of mind, and it's somewhat unusual to find it used in this very specific way, to definitely be a reference to the fourth jhana. And again, this being a characteristic of the verse, that because of the requirements of the meter, that the poets have to be a little bit more creative in how they use the terminology.
Is it possible to have samatha without sati or...?
It's not possible.
How can you have samatha without sati?
No, if you have calm without sati, then it's like the kind of you go into a trance or kind of moha samadhi or something like that. Yeah, go into bhavanga or whatever.
Yeah.
But this is not...
That would be very divine.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I'm going to Sydney and you have to have sati and ask the question and driving.
Yeah. It's making. I mean, these things wouldn't have been controversial in the time of the Buddha. You know, they're not controversial in the suttas themselves.
So the term samadhi refers to jhana, samatha refers to chittabhavan.
Well, chittabhavan. All of those terms basically refer to jhanas, pretty much. I mean, they can be used a little bit more broadly than that, but pretty much that's what they refer to most of the time. Yeah. Okay. Araddha viryo paramattapattiya alina citto akusita vutti dalhanikkamo thama balupapanno eko chare khagavisanakappo. Resolute for the attainment of the supreme goal with intrepid mind, not indolent of firm exertion, furnished with strength and power, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Okay, so we're almost seeing a dhammic progression here, that we started out with more teachings on the sila side of things, and then we've had some which are definitely referring to samadhi, and we're now getting to talking about the paramattapattiya, the attainment of the supreme goal. So we're moving towards nibbana as things go on. It's not a clearly structured sutta, but there is that tendency to give it a progressive structure. Notice that the word paramattha, used in later Abhidhamma tradition to refer to the ultimate truth, paramattha satya, here and elsewhere in the suttas, is used exclusively to mean nibbana, the highest goal. So there's no distinction between conventional truth and ultimate truth found within the early suttas at all. Paramattha only means nibbana.
Abhidhamma, what is the distinction between the two?
Well, according to the Theravadan Abhidhamma system, and it's also found in a similar form in some of the other Abhidhamma systems, that you have a distinction between what they call conventional truth and ultimate truth, or ultimate conventional reality and ultimate reality. And the details of that are worked out a bit differently in different places, but essentially it's a response to the fact that in the suttas sometimes the Buddha says there's no self, but on the other times he's referring obviously to persons and people and things like that. So it's said that the reference to a person is a reference to conventional reality, whereas if you talk, say, about the five khandhas, then this is a reference to ultimate reality. That's the basic tenor of the distinction. But it gets bound up with the kind of the Abhidhamic ontology where the conventional things are said to not really exist truly woolly, whereas the ultimately existing things really truly woolly exist. And of course it being the woolly part of that which is philosophically problematic, and which was criticised by Nagarjuna.
Such as root character.
All of those kinds of things, yeah. So it's basically the idea that there's a kind of an objectively existing underlying substratum of existence, which starts to become problematic. Okay. Where are we now? Okay, not giving up seclusion and meditation, as K.R. Norman has the translation word for meditation, of course, being jhana. Not giving up patisalana, it almost means like retreat. And jhana marinchanano, not neglecting jhana. Dhamesu nichanganu dhammachari adinavang sammasita bhavesu ekochare khagavisana kappo. I'm not giving up seclusion and jhana, constantly living in accordance with the dhamma in the world of phenomena. Not really. Dhammesu nichang anudhammachari, that among dhammas, that one always lives in accordance with dhamma. Something like that. Understanding the peril which is in the various realms of existence, okay, or having considered or reflected on, scrutinized the peril in the various forms of existence, in forms of rebirth. Dhamma kayang battayamat. Pamatto anerla mugo sutva satima sankata dhammo niyato padhanava eko chare khagavisana kappo. Desiring the destruction of craving, dana kayang, or the ending of craving, not negligent, not foolish, learned, possessing mindfulness. Learned is sutva, again suggesting that there's an already existing body of suttas to be learnt. Sutta, the word sutta here doesn't mean sutta. Yes? Everyone understand that? Sutta here means, literally, is a past participle from the word heard, and it means having heard things, okay? And is a word to use to mean learned. Whereas the word sutta, with two T's, means a thread, and it's a word for a discourse. So suttava means having learned things, which actually, of course, means having learned the suttas, but it's a completely different word to the word sutta. Sutra. sapima and mindful. And anela mugo is a great word, literally means like not a dribbling idiot. That's what it means. Don't blame me. Okay. So, not foolish, not a dribbling idiot, and sapima. And a very important point, just so everyone knows and understands this, and I'd, for the whole of your holy life, I want you to remember this and never, ever forget it. Sapima is masculine, not feminine. So anyone who calls a nun sapima is severely grammatically challenged. Okay? I'm not going to go any further on this one, but I have issues. I have grammatical issues about naming of persons according to the actual gender of the word. All right? I mean,
right.
And mudita includes.
Sorry?
Mudita, likewise.
Mudita is okay. Mudita is, if it's a long A, it's feminine. If it's a short A, it's masculine.
Okay. Because what did you say when you met?
Yeah. It normally it is, but it's fairly common that words will be, if they're used as a proper name, can appear in either gender. It's like Sujata and Sujato. This is, the ma part is specifically a masculine ending. Yeah, so Satima, it's a different thing. It's a specific ending. So the actual feminine form is Satimanti. Okay.
Should we just change it to an O?
No, you don't just change it to an O. So I had a friend called Satimanto, which is a plural form. I had another friend called Medino, which was a genitive form. It's just spare me, okay? Just spare me. Right. Okay, not trembling as a lion does not tremble at sounds, not caught up with others as the wind is not caught up with a net, not defiled by passion as a lotus is not defiled by water, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Okay, so here a series of quite beautiful images. The lion that's not scared of anything, like the wind which slips out of a net, and the water which drips off a lotus.
And Asanta Santo is not
training. Yeah, Sadesu Asanta Santo. I'm not 100% sure.
Peaceful.
I think it's a different word. Asanta Santo. I'll try having a look at it. I think it's a different word. It's an unusual. Oh, here we go. Santawank. Oh, Santarati. Related to be frightened or terrified, to fear or be disturbed. Okay, so it's a different root. Tussity, yeah, to be afraid or something. It's obviously quite an unusual poetic idiom. But it's interesting that to notice that with this poetry that we've been looking at, I mean, it has characteristics of poetry. We found the use of the alliterative prefixes, the use of imagery and metaphor and so on. But it's very... it's quite subdued and quite straightforward poetry. It's not at all extravagant. You know, if you look at a lot of Indian poetry and creative work, it's got the, you know, it's just so over the top, you know, so extravagant and so much decoration and this love of proliferation of form for the sake of it and decoration of form. Whereas this is very characteristic of early Buddhist verse, that it's quite direct and quite straightforward. So it's something which seems to almost have been completely lost from the later traditions, and they're just getting caught up in the love of poetics for the sake of it.
And the Buddha was a letter,
wasn't it? Yeah, the poets who distress things up. I think there's, what's it, I can't remember now, one of the later poets who sort of keeps that kind of directness about his stuff. I can't remember his name now. Yeah, it's definitely very characteristic. You find that of, you know, and if you look at things like the Ratna Sutta, Metta Sutta, Mangala Sutta, and so on as well, they're very, very straightforward.
And poetically, stronger.
Mm. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you don't have the whole overload. Yeah. Okay, wandering victorious, having overcome like a strong-toothed lion, the king of beasts. one should resort to secluded lodgings, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Si ho yata datha bali pasaiha raja miganam abibuya chari seve tapantani senasanani eko chare kagovisana kapo. The siha being the lion, and datha bali is like the strong of tooth image, and then the king of beasts, of course, the same idiom, exactly the same you use in English. And Raja Miganang, literally the king of beasts. Abibuya is a word that we find in this kind of verses quite commonly. It literally means having overcome or something like that, having conquered. Cultivating at the right time, loving kindness, equanimity, compassion, release and sympathetic joy. Unimpeded by the whole world, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. My feeling is it's a bit of a misreading. Normally, you've got the metta, upekkha, karuna, and mudita. The sequence of them is disturbed because of the metta, but vimutti is kind of, it would seem normally it would be cultivating at the right time the release of metta, equanimity, compassion, and sympathetic joy. I think grammatically it can be construed either way. It seems that's more...
Seeking release through these things as well?
It doesn't say seeking release through them. It just says cultivating the release, metta, upekkha, compassion, and mudita. Yeah, it doesn't have a through there. But again, with poetry, of course, you always have to interpret it poetically because it is constrained by the meter and so on, and so often the grammatical forms get used that has got pressed into uses which are not always as literal as they are in prose. Exactly, yeah. The vimutti is the jhana level of them. Yeah. And again, here finding, as we've noted many times, the use of straightforward doctrinal categories that are found commonly within the so the prose suttas, and again here occurring once more, Ragancha dosancha pahaya mohang, having abandoned greed, hatred, and delusion, sandali yitwana sanyojanani, having destroyed the fetters, asantasang jivitasang kayamhi, not afraid at the time of the destruction of life, one would wander like a rhinoceros horn. Again, the use of standard doctrinal categories. People associate with and resort to others for some motive. Nowadays, friends without a motive are hard to find. Wise as to their own advantage, men are impure. One should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. Hey, interesting, as a last verse that we've led, you know, quite nicely up to sort of the different stages of development, and then, you know, abandon of greed, hatred, and delusion, and so on. And then this last verse, which is put in there, is not talking about a, you know, high level of development or something. Actually, quite a cynical kind of aspersion on people. Quite interesting why that one's ended up as the final verse. Whether that's just an editorial choice or something like that.
In the next one.
Okay, so this is the rhinoceros horn sutta, and I believe we've got one or two other versions of it around the place. The Gandhari version and so on, if you want to have a look at those. So, the rhinoceros horn sutta is traditionally, according to one of the reasons why it's said to be early, is because there's an early commentary to it. There's actually a canonical commentary called the Nidesa, Mahanidesa and Chulamidesa, and that comments on the rhinoceros horn sutra, the Atikavaga and the Parayanavaga. And it's a very kind of curious commentary that uses this kind of Abhidhamma style of analysis of poetry with somewhat interesting kind of effect, but it's not translated into English. But because it does have a canonical commentary, then this is another reason why it's regarded as being early. And my criticism of that view is that there are actually tons of texts that have much more canonical commentaries Most obvious one being the Parimokkha, which has its whole Vibhanga as a commentary. But things like, say, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta has its own canonical commentary, which is the Satya Vibhanga Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. And if you start to look at it, the Satipatthana Sutta is a canonical commentary on the teaching of the four Satipatthanas, and so on and so forth. So if you actually have to look at texts which are actually commentaries within the four Nikayas, you realize that actually there's plenty of things where earlier teachings are then taken up and commented upon by the Buddha or by other disciples. And these are obviously commentaries in some kind of sense. They're dependent on the previous existence of those teachings, which is assumed. Of course, and obviously would have. Yeah, obviously that these things would have been going on, and the monks would have been saying, "Well, what did you mean by that statement?" And the Buddha then explains it. That's a commentary. He's giving a commentary on his own thing.
Well, probably not even giving a commentary, but other monks, other terrorists who
are hanging around. Absolutely. Both of them would have been happening at the same time. So the fact that there is a commentary on it, of course, it means that it's early to a certain extent, but it doesn't prove that it's earlier than the prose texts. So I'm not trying to question the fact that whether this is an early text, but I am kind of questioning the conclusion which some scholars have read, which is you'll find around the place and which has been quite influential, which is that these texts are actually an earlier strata than the prose. And I don't think there's any foundation for that. I think it's much more likely that the early prose suttas are generally speaking earlier.
Any examples?
I would say most of the prose texts in the Samyutta Nikaya and the Majjhima Nikaya to a large degree. Necessarily, you know, exactly in the edited version that we have them, but pretty much the text. And, you know, as I said, several of those verses you can't really understand without having the knowledge of the prose suttas.
Is it true, as I think we could already know, something Samyutta Nikaya is like a short form of what's in the Majjhima, the concepts which are drawn out in the Majjhima is basically in short form for the Samyutta.
Yeah, well, they share a couple of suttas in common. Mm. Yeah, I mean, the Sutta Nipata is actually very cleverly constructed, actually, and it has almost like a complete curriculum within itself of all the main topics that you need to know. In some ways, I think one of the purposes of Sutta Nipata is because the reciters of the different Nikayas would have tended to specialize in one or other Nikaya. So the Digha reciters would have recited mainly Digha suttas, the Majjhima reciter mainly Majjhima suttas, and the Kuddhika reciters would have recited mainly the Kuddhika suttas, which is mostly poetry. So of course in that poetry you don't find a lot of the basic expositions of the teachings which you find in a lot of other places, like say dependent origination, and even the Four Noble Truths. Like, we didn't have any explicit reference to the Four Noble Truths in that sutta. The jhana formulas, all of these things which are very basic and we find all the way through the prose text are not necessarily found in the verses. So one of the purposes, I think, of compiling the Sutta Nipata was to make sure that the Kuddhika reciters had access to all of those teachings.
Abridging text.
Yeah, yeah. And so
the Dhammapada, kind of similar thing?
Dhammapada, to some extent, I think that was something which the compilers bore in mind when they put together these texts.
Because if it's for most of my reading of the Nikayas, it's not necessarily well formulated, but well structured with some sort of purpose of incremental learning, but pretty much just a shotgun spread. In some ways, there's some structure, but.
Yeah, no, I think there is more to it than that. The structural principles are not the same as we would expect from something that we were reading, but I think that is a major structural principle, and you find that all through the way that the Nikayas are put together. So another example would be, say, the Digha Nikaya. So in the Digha Nikaya, you don't find any long exposition of the Four Noble Truths. Yeah? And so that's why I think that's why the Mahasatipatthana Sutta was constructed, so that the Four Noble Truths, exposition of the Four Noble Truths, is taken from the Satya Vibhanga Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya and then tacked on to the end of the Satipatthana Sutta, and you then call it the Mahasatipatthana Sutta. It's got nothing to do with whether the Buddha actually taught a discourse in that exact form. What it's got to do with is making sure that the Digha reciters had access to that extended.
Has the juicy stuff, or is it
exactly, kind of lost, yeah, in their texts? Yeah, yeah. And what you'd probably find with the Kudika reciters is that these doctrinal categories would then be spelt out in more detail in the commentaries as well, and because they're not spelt out in the actual text so much.
So funny, but when I heard that the Sydney Pāpila seemed like to be an older strata,
yeah.
It seemed plausible to me without thinking about it much, because the voice in some of the verses is so different from anything you find in Vajrayana.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there isn't a lot of verse, you know, elsewhere to compare with, but
right.
Say compared to the Samyutta, the verses, just completely different voice from the Buddha in particular, but
yeah.
Also like the Parayavaga, the whole kind of narrative thing.
Yeah,
it's it just has such an authentic feel to it, and
mm-hmm.
just poetically, just you know, pops out. Very different.
Yeah.
And so,
look, I agree with that completely. Yeah, I mean, on a subjective level, there's a way of responding to it where it is quite different and quite authentic. And so, I think that those verses, again, it is quite likely that those things were said early and were preserved in an accurate form down through those years. That doesn't mean that the whole Suttanipata was like that, and it doesn't mean that those verses are necessarily earlier than the basic prose teaching either. Yeah, so that's all. So I'm not trying to say that they're not early and that they're not special in that way. Just some of the more, I think, more extreme inferences that were drawn from that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the extreme inferences are that things like the Suttanipata are really genuine.
Basically, yeah, yeah, and I mean, I've heard of one monk who apparently was living in Burma, one Western monk, and he was like Atthakavagga only. Everything else is later, right? So the only Buddhavacana is the Atthakavagga. So which we'll have a look at next. We're now 5:30, so we don't have that much time, but I'll just have a look very briefly at the Atthakavagga and look maybe one or two of the things here. Here's the little article in the Wikipedia. Atthakavagga is the fourth chapter, and we do not have a great deal of information about the earliest phases of Buddhist thought, the form of the religion predating its later codification in the established canons and practices of the early Buddhist schools and later innovations like Mahayana. Some texts, however, have been identified by scholars as being earlier than others, for example, in the Suttanipata, which is a branch of the Kuddhika Nikaya of the Sutta Pitaka. In the Dipitaka, there are two small collections of suttas, the Atthakavagga and the Parayanavagga, which some scholars regard as being considerably earlier in composition than the bulk of the canon and as revealing an earlier form of the religion. They are regarded as earlier because of elements of language and composition. Okay, so the linguistic elements is that there are certain vocabulary and certain grammatical forms which are early and which hark back to Vedic period. The contradiction to that is that there are also other verses in the canon, such as Saggatavagga or the Sanyutta Nikaya, which in some cases are regarded as even having earlier. Their inclusion in very early commentaries, which we've already remarked about, and also because some have seen them as expressing versions of certain Buddhist beliefs that are different from and perhaps prior to their later codified versions. Okay, one of the issues here, and which comes out strongly in the Kagavisana Sutta, is the issue of monastic life versus the life of a solitary hermit living in the forest. Okay, and there's a tendency among scholars to reify particular texts as referring to particular historical strata. Yeah, so we have a particular reading of a particular text, and we assume that this refers to some kind of existing situation in the real world. And of course, there's a great inference from that. There's no reason whatsoever why the Buddha shouldn't have spoken to one group of people and then praised communal living for that group of people, and then spoken to somebody else and then praised solitary living. Yeah, and in fact, there's no need to think of that the very fact that something is praised and spoken of actually correlates to a historical stage. It may be the exact opposite. The fact may have been that it's because all the monks were living together and associating with each other and spending all their time hanging around and chatting with each other. That's why the Buddha gave the verses in praise of solitude. Yeah? So in fact, there may be an inverse relationship between the text and the historical reality. So this is why we can't draw any simple conclusions. So all of these kinds of things should be taken on board as hypotheses. So you say, well, this, with this evidence, if you read it in this way, then it might lead to these kind of conclusions, and then you can see what implications that might have. But one other problem with this is that there's this idea, which is early Buddhism, the monks would live alone in the forest. And I say monks because in that stage, the bhikkhuni, whether they existed or not, are not usually thought of in that stage. And then later on was the development of settled communal monasticism. Now clearly that obviously happened, but then the question is over what time period did it happen? So if you read the time period as seemed to be assumed within the Vinaya itself, where this is talked about, it seemed to be over a few years that it started out, you know, they were living by themselves, and then over the first few years then monasteries were allowed and were settled fairly quickly. What the scholars, or some scholars, want to argue is that period lasted for much longer than that, and that the emergence of settled monasticism maybe didn't happen till after the Buddha died, maybe it didn't happen till a few hundred years. Gregory Chopin even tries to argue on fairly flimsy archaeological evidence that it didn't happen till maybe 400 years after the Buddha passed away. But that's a fairly extreme point of view. So again, there's no doubt some truth to that, and so there's a flexibility there. But one thing to also notice is that one of the reasons why there's a tension here is because it's assumed that things like the Kagyavisana Sutta and the Atthakarthavagga are given to in a context of solitary ascetic life, whereas the bulk of the suttas are given in the context of a settled monastic life. But that assumption is actually almost entirely derived simply from the setting material in which the suttas are given. So these suttas don't have any setting material, it's just the verses. We don't hear anything about where they were spoken, who they were spoken to, or anything like that. Now if we look at the actual suttas, in the narrow sense of what is actually spoken by the Buddha, then they too often don't give any indication of a settled monastic life or anything like that. He just says the five khandhas are impermanent, what is impermanent is not self, what is not self, and so on. So we just have those things. It's only in the background material that we see a reference to the Buddha staying in Savatthi, in the Jetavana and Atapindika's grove, and so on. So that background material is what establishes it as within a monastic environment. So there's no reason to assume that because the background material comes from a stage of monastic development that the actual teaching itself does. Okay? And that's quite apparent in teachings like the gradual training and a Upabhasika, where we have quite an extensive description of the monastic life and the kind of silas which a monk should be living in, and yet there's really no mention of a monastery life as such, and it just refers to coming back from alms round and going into the forest and sitting and meditating and so on. So you couldn't assume just from the meat of the doctrine there that it's actually talking about a monastic life at all. It's actually quite neutral. So this is why I think that this thesis, again, I'm not trying to say that it's completely mistaken in any way, but just trying to say I think it's been greatly overstated. Okay.
It would be hard to argue with Chopin. Yeah, with Chopin's view, and to not argue but agree with his view, because the bulk of the Padimokkha was already kind of in effect before the Buddha passed away. And that a lot of that Padimokkha kind of refers to communal life,
It does. The Padimokkha certainly does. I mean, that would be one strong argument against Chopin. Chopin is very sceptical about the age of all the Buddhist texts,
yeah.
And so he probably would be hard to convince him that the Padimokkha of any early date for the Padimokkha.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think he's almost alone on that. I don't know if there's any serious scholars of Buddhist texts that would really question that.
Mm-hmm.
But you're quite right. The Padimokkha refers to buildings and to leaving, you know, monastery beds out in the open and things like that. So clearly, you know, refers to you know, personally, I think it's, you know, I think it's also just impractical and ridiculous to think that you can have a community where you've got old people and sick people and all of these things who are just living out in the forest for decades or centuries. I think it's ridiculous. I mean, obviously, you know, you had this reform in recent years in Vietnam with the mendicant order, and that's what they did originally, but it only lasted a few years. And then they say, well, actually, you know, you have to have buildings and people have to have places to stay. And most likely, you know, you would have seen a gradual development of the settled monastic life together with a strong arm of wandering bhikkhus and later bhikkhunis just wandering everywhere, as you still have in the Sangha today in the forest traditions in Sri Lanka and Thailand.
Indeed, you would lose the sufficiency of a character like Mahakasapa in the background,
uh-huh.
there'd be no relief for a person like that if everybody's standard practice was forestry pundits.
Exactly.
What makes Mahakasapa so special? Everybody's living in the
yeah,
forest.
Absolutely. You know, yeah. Very good point.
He's
yeah.
great. Yeah, he's in the tree or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same. So in 1994, a group of texts, which are the earliest Indian manuscripts discovered, were found in Gandhara. These texts include a relatively complete version of the Rhinoceros Sutra and textual material from the Atkavaga and Parayanavaga. Okay, so here's some of the modern theories about it. Generally speaking, the Atkavaga and Parayanavaga tend more strongly to emphasize the negative sides of asceticism. Asceticism is a process of negating desire, and show a strong concern with regulating everyday bodily activities and sensual desires, according to some scholars, but not all. They also place considerable emphasis on the rejection of all views and are reluctant to put forward positions of their own regarding basic metaphysical issues. This has caused some commentators to compare them with later Madhyamaka philosophy, which in its Prasangika form especially makes a method of rejecting others' views rather than proposing its own. No, you're probably quite right. This probably more applies to the Atikawada. Yeah. So then Vetters continue that, and he notes that neither of the short collections of suttas are homogenous, and hence not all amenable to Gomez's proposals, according to Vetter. Those sutras which do lend to support Dr. Gomez probably originated with a heterodox ascetic group that predated the Buddha and were integrated into the Buddhist Sangha at an early date, bringing with them some suttas that were already in existence and also composing further suttas in which they tried to combine their own teachings with those of the Buddha. Thus, if both Gomez and Vetter are correct, Prasangika Madhyamaka would represent a continuation of a heterodox strand within Buddhism, rather than either a totally or largely orthodox one as held by some scholars. Yeah, this is all a bit... Possibly, yeah. There's certainly a tendency of a similarity, but whether there's actually any historical link between them is a bit overblown, really. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a connection between things which are like 700-800 years separated in time. Anyway... going on, interpretation is orthodox. Paul Fuller from Sydney University, a local boy, well, he's local now, has rejected the arguments of Gomez and Vetter. He finds that the Nikayas and the Atikavaga present the same cognitive attitude towards views, wrong or right. He states that in the Nikayas, right view includes non-dependence on knowledge and views, and mentions the Buddha's simile of his Dhamma as a raft that must be abandoned. He finds the Atikavaga's treatment of knowledge and wisdom is parallel to the later Patthana, is the Abhidhamma book, apparent criticism of giving, holding the precepts, duty of observance, and practicing the jhanas. In his view, both texts exhibit this particular approach, not as an attack on practice or knowledge, but to point out that attachment to the path is destructive. Similarly, the text's treatment of concentration meditation is intended to warn against attachment to insight and to communicate that insight into the nature of things necessarily involves a calm mind. Okay, so it's just to show that this, I'm glad that Paul Fuller's done this thing, because I think it's just a case where there's some truth to the idea that you presented with things in a bit of a different way, but it's just been way overblown. I think sometimes in the academic world, you get a bit of kudos from making radical theses, which in a sense is all part of the game, you know. And you propose it, you make an extreme statement, and then it gets modified and moderated, and that's part of the process. The Buddhist tradition has itself taken the view that the text statements, including many which are clearly intended to be paradoxical, are meant to be puzzled over and explicated. And it appears refers to the commentary of Mahanidesa. It's attributed to Sariputta, obviously it's much later than Sariputta. But more than that, but there are actually internal, some of the verses from the Atikavaga and Parayanavaga are actually commented on within the Nikayas themselves, not just in Nidesa, but actually within the Nikayas you find, I think, three or four of the verses are actually picked up and questioned and given quiet extended and allegorical interpretations within the Nikayas themselves, so they're not treated at all literally. There'd be a list of them somewhere. They're in the Sanyutta Nikaya and Anguttara Nikaya. I can't remember the references off the top of my head. For example, there's one verse which says one wanders without a home, and then that's interpreted as meaning without being attached to the five khandhas or something like that. Whereas obviously the original verse was referring to literally not having a home. Yeah. Okay, so we're kind of running out of time, so I won't go too much into here, but let's just have a look at one of the classic Atikavagga suttas, and this will give you some idea of what was being talked about this. We can maybe have a look at some more later, but just to have a look at why this thing was talked about. Okay, so here is the purified Suddhataka Sutta. It starts out with like a quote from someone, probably from an unknown or ascetic or something like that. Pasami suddhan paramangarogan. I see that which is pure and which is the highest form of wholeness, or literally lack of disease. Purity comes to a man by means of what he has seen, dipena. Okay, so this refers to the ancient Indian belief in the darsana. So you see somebody who's pure or something like that, and then you can actually have that spiritual connection that will cause that, transmit that purity to yourself. Understanding this, knowing it is the highest, and thinking I am a seer of the purified, he believes that knowledge leads to purity. Okay, so this is a description of what some people think. If purity, and then this is the response to it, dipena che suddhi narasahoti, but if purity comes to a man through what he has seen, or if he abandons misery by means of knowledge, then he who has acquisitions leading to rebirth is purified by something other than the noble path, for his view betrays him as he speaks thus. Okay, so here it's almost criticizing the idea that here it uses the word ditti as a view, and also jnana. So normally in Buddhism we use jnana in the sense of an insight, but here in these verses the word jnana is closely connected with the idea of a view. So it's not necessarily an insight knowledge, but if you have, it's almost like a second-hand knowledge. The Brahman, here Brahman using in a Buddhist sense as the purified person, does not say that purity comes from someone else, nor is it what is seen or heard in virtuous conduct or vows or in what is thought. Not clinging to merit or evil, he abandons what has been taken up and does not fashion anything more here. All right, so obviously Bruno didn't get enlightened. Na brahmano ditte in what is seen, heard, silavate mute. So these are the basic categories: what is seen, what is heard, what is muta. Sometimes translated as sensed, but that doesn't mean that at all. It means thought. Okay, so here, ditta, sutta, and mutta are various forms of knowledge, from what you've seen, from what you've heard from someone, and from what you've thought and reasoned among in yourself. And silavata. So he's saying you can't get purity from any of those things, but it's by not clinging to good and evil, he abandons what has been taken up and does not make anything more. So this again is very characteristic of this kind of suttani path, or this Atikavagga kind of verses. This is why it's often aligned with this kind of non-dualistic thinking, what's not attached to good or evil, punya to papeja. And just as a linguistic note, in this particular strand we have the word atta used quite commonly. We'll find it a few times used in these verses, but it doesn't mean the self. It means what is taken up or what is grasped. It's a different word. Abandoning their former teacher, they are dependent upon another. Those under the influence of lust do not cross over attachment. They seize and let go like a monkey releasing a branch after seizing it. Whether it means a former, it says teacher in brackets here. I wonder if it means a former existence rather than teacher. But I guess the teacher probably comes from a commentary. Anyway. A person undertaking vows himself, being attached to perceptions, goes high and low. One who knows, the one of great wisdom, does not go high and low, having understood the doctrine by means of the knowledges of the way. One is sannyasato, one is attached to perception. He is not associated with any dhammas, or with whatever is seen or heard or thought, or whatever is dipta, sutta, mutta, the same phrase we heard before. How could anyone here in the world have doubts about him when he has such insight and conducts himself properly? or openly. And this phrase, the Ditta Sutta Mutta, is very important in this strata and always refers to basically to second-hand knowledge, a knowledge which you've received from another, what's seen, heard or thought out. They do not form views, nakapayanti. They do not prefer, napurekaranti. They do not say this is the highest purity, achanta suddhiti, nate varanti. Releasing the knot of grasping which has been tied, agadanagantang gatitang visajja asang nakubanti kuhincha loke. They do not form the desire for anything in the world. And just a little linguistic note here, this use of the word kubanti is actually the verb to do. More commonly we find in karoti, and kubanti being a specific archaic poetic form. And we found it there, and we found it also up here, pakubamano. So this kind of usage, which is also one of the linguistic markers, which is why these verses are said to be early. The Brahman has gone beyond the sima. He says, simatigo, he's gone outside the sima. Brahmatigo tasanati, he has nothing. What does it say? Brahman, simatigo brahmano tasanati. Oh, there's nothing which is seen, which is known or seen, which is grasped at. He is not impassioned by passion. He is not attached to the passionless. Nothing further is grasped by him here. And so again, this very non-dual kind of way of talking. Na raga ragi na viraga ratto. He's not in love with love, and he's not in love with unlove. One way of putting it, or he doesn't lust after lust, or doesn't lust after de-lust, etc. I think you get the idea here. But obviously, this normally in the suttas you find the expression that you abandon desire and you head towards dispassion, whereas here it seems to you say you let go of both passion and dispassion. So again, this is one of the reasons why they've kind of sought to find a kind of different sort of doctrine being taught in these verses. Sorry? Sima, yeah, there's really boundaries. Yeah, it's gone beyond limitations. Yeah.
Would that be samsara?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Big Sima.
10,000-fold chili cotton. Yeah, I mean, it's a great phrase. It'd be a good name, actually, wouldn't it? Simatigo. One's gone outside the sima. There you go. Come back in here, we need to finish the parimokkha. Yeah, I mean, personally, I really like these verses. Not even look at the whole sutta here, but just at the ending of this one. This is also very characteristic of the Suttanapata verses. This is in the Duttataka Sutta. We'll just be a minute. Just two verses here. A purified man, the Dhonasa, one who's had a bath, does not indeed form a view anywhere in the world in respect to which soap is better than the other. Doesn't say that, okay, but I just thought I'd put that in the kapita ditti bhava bhavesu, various kinds of rebirth. Where would a purified man go, having abandoned illusion and conceit? Mayancha manancha pahaya dhono. Here's the word maya, mana. Where would they go? He is not involved. Anupaya. So here's the word for upaya, which we normally hear means skillful means, but here it means not involved with anything. Sakena gacheya anupayoso. Beautiful, that last verse. I really love that last line there. Where someone who's not involved with anything, where would they go? And then the last verse, an involved person, anupaya, is involved with disputes in respect of doctrines. Okay, then they discuss or dispute about doctrines. Anupayang, one without upaya. Yeah, so again, just notice the complete difference in the way upaya is used in the early suttas as opposed to the later usage we're used to. And here, upaya means basically getting caught up in things. So anyone who's caught up in things is someone who has upaya. Someone who, if one's not involved or not caught up in things, then what is there to discuss or what is there to argue about? Atta nirata nahitasa ati. He has nothing that's either taken up or put down. You know? And so again, this word atta here, meaning not self, but meaning attachment or holding on to something. So this is, again, it's a different word than the word atman, meaning self. It means he doesn't have anything which is taken up or anything which is put down. Adhosi so dittamidheva sabbanti. He is abandoned and shaken off all views right here. So, yeah, I've got very beautiful verses. So, let's see how we go. Maybe after the after I get back from Melbourne, we can do a bit more on these. So, I can do it. Rini, of course. Absolutely. Oh, well, you need to find the right sutta for the context, you know. When you want to get involved in an issue, you find a sutta that justifies that, and when you've done that, you go back to your kutti, you recite this one. Oh, it doesn't take up, or have done anything, and you just sit in your kutti, oh, I'm peaceful, I can leave that behind. No, seriously. You know? Because all of these things, if you take a verse like that as being a complete absolute, that's meant, you know, that if you take it in a way that it was never given, right, it was never given as an absolute separate thing, which was divorced from life and divorced from the reality of getting food and having a house and talking to people and all of those things. And you say, this is my absolute philosophy of life, and I'm going to apply this in a black and white way in every context, regardless of what happens. Well, it'd be a complete nightmare. You know, you say, well, I'm not picking up or putting anything down, right? Okay, well. you can't live. So these things are meant to be like there's a reflection. It's something. It's something which you apply in context, and you see, well, what's happening? You know. So if you find, for example, if you find that you're getting caught up, say in disputes and arguing. See, this is, remember, this is a lot of these were taught in the kind of the ascetic culture of the Buddha and the Indian, not of the Buddha, the ascetic culture of India at that time, the Samana culture, where people love to debate and argue with each other. And so you see all through the Majjhima Nikaya and the Digha Nikaya, that's what they love to do. And so this is one of the things that it's talking about. Look, if you're just going around disputing and arguing with people about the truth, then you're never going to find peace of mind. So in a way, it has to be understood in terms of the actual ascetic culture of India at the time. Yeah.
Can you give kind of within an environment that there's dispute and everything, and still be not taking it up?
Absolutely, yeah. Because you know you have to be. You know, you can't. There's always, people always have differences of view and opinion and things like that.
It seems the Buddha didn't like to hang around communities that had a dispute, aka constantly. He's like, well, you know, good luck, guys.
Yeah, I mean, that was after it had already developed to a very bad stage and he tried to solve it and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and in that case, it was obviously, it was a chicken and duck situation, you know. I mean, they were arguing about something completely meaningless, you know. So that's, again, quite different, but, you know. But there's, you know, as I said, there are plenty of suttas where the Buddha went and had arguments with Brahmins and things like that. You know? But he wasn't just doing it because he delighted in it.
He also didn't necessarily hang around those communities that were in Concord anyway.
Mm.
Wasn't attached to that either.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but that's another attachment. You know, if you're attached to being in a place where nobody ever argues,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's where that can be much worse. Yeah. Enough for today.